It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, weird fiction. Stories on the creepy, freaky, fantastical side, where reality bends and warps and supernatural beings walk among us.
You know, the Greek gods feel like us. You read stories about what the Greek gods did and you go, okay, I get this. This is us. You read a good Egyptian god story and you go, maybe they came down from space.
Today, Neil Gaiman, H.P. Lovecraft, and the other gods of weird fiction, including the newest star in this fictional firmament, Jeff Vandermeer. To get a sense of his new novel, Annihilation, imagine that the government has sealed off part of Florida because people had started dying there and strange new life forms began popping up. Now the government is sending a team of scientists into this mysterious Area X.
The tower, which was not supposed to be there, plunges into the earth in a place just before the black pine forest begins to give way to swamp. Beyond the marsh flats and the natural canals lies the ocean, and a little farther down the coast, a derelict lighthouse. All of this part of the country has been abandoned for decades, for reasons that are not easy to relate. Our expedition was the first to enter Area X for more than 2 years, and much of our predecessors' equipment had rusted, their tents and sheds little more than husks. Looking out over that untroubled landscape, I do not believe any of us could yet see the threat.
That's the opening passage of Jeff Vandermeer's novel Annihilation. It's the first book in his Southern Reach trilogy, which is creating quite a buzz. Not only are all three books being released in a single year, Paramount Pictures has snapped up the movie rights. Steve Paulson has been reading the books and had a few sleepless nights as a result.
Jeff, how would you describe the basic premise of your Southern Reach trilogy in this strange wilderness area that seems to be in some part of Florida?
Right, yes. It's actually kind of based on my hiking in North Florida, although it's a very disguised setting. But basically, it's about this area called Area X, and mysterious things are happening there. People can't quite figure out what's going on, and the government has this secret agency, the Southern Reach, to investigate this place that's behind this invisible border.
So four women go on an expedition into Area X. What are they looking for?
Basically, they're first of all looking to survive, I would imagine. the problem with these expeditions, and they don't really get a sense of this until they're already mired or embedded in Area X, but the prior expeditions haven't gone very well. And so, for example, they don't refer to themselves by their names, and they also don't use modern communication technology, both of these things because, in a nutshell, it appears that whatever is in Area X, whatever is changing this landscape, can hack into the human mind a little easier if those things are in play.
And when you say previous expeditions have gone awry, I mean, basically, the people have either died or they've gone crazy.
Right, and it's almost as if they've been unable to receive certain types of incoming information, or they've simply been unable to handle it, or Area X is affecting them in ways that they don't quite understand.
Now, it would seem clear that there's some kind of alien civilization that is present in Area X. I mean, different kind of intelligence, different laws of biology. Is that fair to say?
I guess it would. I mean, the thing of it is that I think if we encounter something truly unknowable or beyond what the limits of our knowledge or our science are, that it's going to either manifest as something that seems either perhaps, I guess you'd say, magical or completely inscrutable to some degree. And so it's really hard for the Southern Reach, for these expeditions, to get a grasp on exactly what it is they're even looking at.
Is there a real-life correlate to the sort of the geography that you're describing in Area X? I mean, it's kind of swampy, semi-tropical. Are you sort of basing this on any real-life place?
Yeah, actually, there's a 14-mile trail that I hike out at the St. Mark's Wildlife Refuge here in North Florida, and it's a very transitional landscape. It does exactly what the landscape in Annihilation does. It goes from pine forest to kind of cypress-knee black water swamp to marshlands and then out to the coast, and it's a really unique ecosystem. It is very personal to me. I mean, there's not a single detail of the landscape in Annihilation that isn't from firsthand observation. It's also kind of interesting because people who aren't used to that landscape or don't know it find the book to be stranger than people who do. Like, for example, there's a scene in there where there's a dolphin in a freshwater canal. And there's something strange about the dolphin that doesn't happen in real life, obviously. But there's also the fact that dolphins do come up at high tides through the marshland, through the water passages, and you can find them in the freshwater channels there.
So this is a pretty wild place that you go hiking in. I mean, with large, potentially dangerous creatures.
Yes, actually, I have been charged by a wild boar out there, which is more hilarious than it sounds. Because I was out there hiking with a friend at the time, and it charged us from a long distance away on a path that had water on either side, and we'd already been hiking for like 7 miles, so we were not inclined to be doing much running away from this thing. But it charged from so far away, like 200 feet, that we had a lot of time to talk about what we were going to do, which is not something you expect, right? And so about 15 feet away, the thing veered off into the water and swam away, and this kind of blew our minds because neither of us had remembered in our kind of semi-panic there that pigs could swim. So it was never an option to us that it was going to veer off the path into the water. And so that is actually a scene that made it in non-comic fashion into the novel, this charging of this boar and the strangeness surrounding that.
Now, I heard that the original idea for these books came from a dream. Is that right?
It did. And I kind of primed my subconscious. I kind of do this. I kind of say, subconscious, I really want to write about Florida more directly than I have in the past. So say that to my brain, and then months later I have this dream. And in the dream, I'm going down this tunnel, and I start seeing this living material on the wall that's forming letters. And the creepy thing, and also it's like darkly comic to me at least, is I notice that they're getting fresher, which means there's something down below that's making these words. And at a certain point, I see this kind of glow. And this is one of those dreams where you don't know that you're dreaming, you know, one of those terrible things where it's like, oh, my God, I'm actually in this situation.
Otherwise known as a nightmare to some people.
Well, okay, yes. I should. I guess it would be a nightmare if it had never turned into a story. Then I would be calling it a nightmare. But since I have in some way profited from it creatively, I'll call it a dream. So I get to this point where I realize the glow is right there, and if I turn the corner, I'm going to see what's down there doing it. And that's when my writer brain, I believe, basically airlifted me out of the situation. Suddenly my brain was telling me, this is a dream, you need to wake up. And I think that if I hadn't woken up, pretty much I would have wound up not writing the story, that I needed to not see that thing in order to write the story. And so I woke up, I wrote, scribbled down all those ideas. Then in the morning, I had the character of the biologist in my head, I had a rough story arc. So all of these things my subconscious has been working hard on to try to explain the dream, I guess. And so it was a very easy novel to write for that reason.
But it's fascinating because, I mean, you're really saying that you consciously set out to sort of get in touch with your subconscious. And I'm thinking especially for the kind of books that you write. I mean, you are – I mean, we can talk about how to categorize your kind of fiction, but they're a bit on the science fiction side. They're kind of surreal. I mean, it would seem that your task in a way is to get out of seeing ordinary reality. You know, so the question is, how do you do that? I mean, how do you tap into that part of your mind?
Well, it's a really – it's a perilous question too. I mean, one thing I learned really early on is never have a dream sequence in my own fiction. Because sometimes the effects are kind of Kafkaesque and dreamlike to begin with. So you put a dream in there and it just immediately all the tension kind of goes out of the story.
Are you asking questions about what's real and maybe what's just beyond what's real?
Well, you know, it's funny. You know, in a sense, I feel like over the last 20 years, the world has become less real because of the fact that we can't even sometimes agree on what a fact is. And so I think to some degree, I'm dealing with the limits of what we think science can be and do, because I still think science needs to be allied to philosophy. And one thing that I think that kind of weird or surreal fiction gets at is the irrationality of the world.
You and your wife, Anne, edited a big anthology of stories called The Weird. You know, you've talked about weird fiction. Is this just another word for science fiction, or is it something different?
I think it's a more useful word to discuss certain types of fiction, because the one thing that weird fiction does is it's not a marketing category. You won't find it in a bookstore. It also repairs, I would call, what I'd call a rift between so-called genre and so-called literary, which is something that my wife and I pretty much ignore anyway. But it allowed us to bring together writers who were working in with similar material, kind of dark fiction that's dealing with the unknown.
Who would be some of those writers?
Well, there are stories of Borges's that qualify. There's Murakami, some of his more surreal stories. Also, of course, people like Ray Bradbury. you look at these writers and there's all these connections that you wouldn't have thought of.
And it seems like this is quite different from what I would consider to be fantasy. I mean, you're not dealing with magic and sorcerers and that kind of thing.
No, not at all. I mean, you can say, for example, vampires, zombies, and werewolves are not weird because you know what those things are. As soon as they pop up in a story, they bring all this baggage of associations with them.
So you actually – so what you're drawn to is the unexplainable, the inexplicable.
The unexplainable and trying to explain it and trying to come to terms with it. And in a sense, you could see that shift occurring in fiction because it was shifting out of the Gothic, which was much more probably, I guess you'd say, Christian influence to some degree and ghosts and all of that, and then sliding into this modern era where the world seemed perhaps more complex and more brutal and more everything. And, you know, some explanations for that come out of science. Some of them still come out of religion. Some of them in stories from some of these writers, they were just basically trying to make sense of it all.
Are you dealing with the supernatural?
In these books?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that an interest of yours to explore what the supernatural might mean?
It is in the sense of what people think of it in their minds. I'm not so much into the supernatural itself. I'm kind of more into the supernatural as it's expressed as superstition and absurdity. If you study even just parts of the natural world, you begin to wonder if you're actually living on an alien planet, that there are so many incredible things that go on around us. I mean, they found out recently that albatrosses and sunfish have a symbiotic connection. Now, that to me is not necessarily supernatural, but it speaks of kind of a weird sense of wonder, if that makes any sense. I find those kinds of details to be interesting and kind of beautiful in a way. And so, you know, maybe the books in a way explore kind of the gap or the transition or the way that science and all these other things come together, but not the supernatural directly. It's about individual human beings trying to come to terms with the unknown and the inexplicable, trying to make sense of it. And in some cases, that takes a spiritual turn.
Jeff Vandermeer is the author of Annihilation and Authority, the first books in his Southern Reach trilogy. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Some writers are proud to call their work science fiction. Others consider genre fiction a dead-end ghetto. We asked sci-fi and fantasy legend Ursula Le Guin what she thinks.
You know, science fiction has always been for geeks. We're all geeks that write science fiction. I'm about the geekiest 15-year-old girl you ever saw. Some of it is more like fantasy in the sense of it, I'm really just doing it for the pleasure of invention. Just the way a musician invents a tune and fleshes it out into a symphony. I invent a place or some people and make a world of them. I get a lot of pleasure doing that, and apparently a lot of readers share the pleasure. A good science fiction novel often follows an idea through. Take something like Philip Dick's Man in the High Castle, where the idea is simply that Germany and Japan won the Second World War and America is an occupied country. Part of the joy of reading that wonderful book is just the way he works it out. What would it be like if? And somehow we all seem to enjoy doing that. Forty years ago, there was a certain refusal to write very well, to write literarily, among a great many science fiction writers, most of whom were men, many of whom were trained in engineering and similar fields. They just wanted to tell a story. A lot of early science fiction was pretty crude. The idea that all science fiction is just ideas and it's badly written and all that, that simply comes from people who don't read it. To be labeled a genre writer is, in the eyes of about 90% of readers, is to be labeled second rate. So obviously a lot of people bristle and say, well, all right, I'm a sci-fi writer and I'm proud of it, you know. I wish they'd forget the darn labels. A lot of my books are really not, they don't classify easily as science fiction. They may be fantasy, but that may not be the important thing about them. These genre labels are marketing labels. They make it easy for readers who are addicted to a certain type of fiction to find it in the library or the bookstore. They make it real, real easy for the publisher to sell it. Otherwise, they are useless, and they can be very misleading. I don't care what genre they say I'm writing in. I have this book I want to write. I wish you'd just unstick the labels from me and just read the book, you know, and decide what it is yourself.
The legendary science fiction and fantasy writer Ursula Le Guin. She's won the Hugo, Nebula, Locus, and World Fantasy Awards, each more than once. Coming up, the soundscape of H.P. Lovecraft's fictional universe, and rock star fantasy writer Neil Gaiman channels his childhood. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking this hour about weird fiction, and so we have to mention H.P. Lovecraft, the godfather of the modern horror story. He died in 1937, but his stories have influenced writers from Stephen King to Joyce Carol Oates to Jorge Luis Borges. And a truly astonishing number of heavy metal bands have written lyrics and even entire albums based on his work. Lovecraft had a special talent for conjuring up things so monstrous, words couldn't quite describe them. A while back, Jim Fleming talked with media theorist Dean Lockwood about how Lovecraft created those trademark creepy atmospheres with sound.
In Lovecraft stories, there's a lot of attention given to the possibility that our exposure to certain weird things in the world will drive us insane. There's that element of insanity. But I think that Lovecraft is perhaps more interested in our bodily responses to horror, affect. So he talks about the way in which sounds, for example, have a kind of physical impact. He describes sounds that are not really sounds, that are something else. He describes them as sense impacts. So I think rather than sound, Lovecraft is really interested in vibration, in some kind of alien vibration flooding our bodies.
And you say that Lovecraft actually defined the weird in sonic terms. What was it exactly that he said?
He says that we should understand the weird as an attitude of awed listening, as if we were listening for the beating of black wings or some kind of scratching at the edge of the known universe.
You also refer to the fantasy writer Fritz Lieber, who thought that Lovecraft was the Copernicus of horror fiction.
Yeah, because he turns everything around. For Lovecraft, the horror is really the cosmos that we find within ourselves. It's the black gulf, the interstellar gulf within humanity. There's something non-human, something alien that's at the heart of our existence. And all of his best stories, I think, are encounters with this otherness, this weirdness within.
Well, let's talk about some of the stories, because it's the best way to define it. One of his most famous is called The Call of... This is a word that everybody disagrees on the pronunciation of.
Sure.
I've always said Cthulhu. Is that close?
I would say Cthulhu, yeah. So these words are a nice device for alienating us from our own speech, our own language.
It's almost easier to see on the page, isn't it? Because the C-T-H-U-L-U, it's almost frightening in of itself.
That's right.
And he uses that sound within his stories, doesn't it? He distances us from our reality by refusing to use just the words we know.
That's right. Part of the experience of reading Lovecraft is to try and get your head around this language, this strange form of expression. And it's not just the individual words or the alien languages that he's invented. It's actually a matter of his style as well. One of the things about Lovecraft is that he has a certain notoriety for being an appalling writer, which I think is probably quite mistaken. I think there's something quite deliberate in the way that his convoluted, contorted style is again a way of introducing a certain kind of alienation into the reading experience.
Well, there's a quote from him that you have in your essay. There are vocal qualities peculiar to men and vocal qualities peculiar to beasts, and it is terrible to hear the one when the source should yield the other. Again, it's taking us out of our comfort zone with common language.
Yeah, the alien presences, the monsters within Lovecraft, the various entities, one of the things that they tend to have in common is that they inveigle themselves into human communities. They imitate human behavior, human language, and human speech. So in a story such as The Whisper in Darkness, it's precisely about discovering that those around you are imposters and that there's something very wrong with them. This idea of mongrel vibrations, there's something mongrel or mixed about humans, that they have this element of alienness within them, which in Lovecraft often manifests in very disturbing ways. It's well known that he was extremely racist. It could be interpreted, this kind of fear of the alien and this preoccupation with the alien is an inflection of that racist, but it becomes something else, I think. It becomes something more kind of existential, you might say.
And it is that sound that taking it into an era that all of us find a little irritating. He especially found insect sounds. Well, maybe he found them appealing. I don't know.
I think it's because he's interested in this idea of the strange cosmos in which we find ourselves. That's why I talk about weird ecology. Our lives are entangled with really unsuspected forms of life, ways of being, ways of sensing, new sensations. And one of the ways he figures these new sensations is through imagining a kind of insectile form of life. So insects are his monsters, his creatures. They speak in ways which betray their kinship with insects. So they speak and the language breaks down into a kind of buzzing or rasping, as if they were insects, really.
In this story, in fact, one of the characters makes phonograph recordings, doesn't he? And hears that insectile drone behind the words that he's recording?
That's right.
Ea Shub Nigurat, the black goat of the woods with a thousand young.
And in that story, the beings, are they insects?
They're a strange amalgamation of insects. He describes them as having bat wings and having torsos like flying prawns. They're a strange hybrid, a strange chimera of different animal parts that together make up something that is completely unknown.
There's another story that you wrote about, Beyond the Wall of Sleep. In that one, he imagines, what, a cosmic radio apparatus? What's that?
Well, it's a device which facilitates telepathy and access to these realms beyond, to these spaces that are around us all the time, but our senses aren't equipped to detect. So he imagines that a new technology could be invented which plugs us into those weird realms around us, which is a frightening prospect. Often Lovecraft is made sense of in terms of being a kind of response to society and politics around him, the First World War, for example, or changes in capitalism. But also, I think one of the things that's rarely remarked upon is that the year that he really starts to write his best-known cosmic horror stories, which is 1926, with Call of Cthulhu, was also the year in which the first national network radio station in America began broadcasting. So the great phase of cosmic horror in Lovecraft's writing coincides with really the inception of commercial radio broadcasting, which he never actually overtly discusses, but it must have had a huge impact upon him. Suddenly these radio sets within the home, the tentacles of commerce creeping into everyday life, a kind of living with this new kind of noise, if you like. I suspect that given Lovecraft's interest in science and technology, was something that filters through into his stories.
Dean Lockwood is a media theorist at the University of Lincoln in the UK. He talked with Jim Fleming about his essay, Mongrel Vibrations, H.P. Lovecraft's Weird Ecology of Noise. One of the best-known writers of mythic fiction is Neil Gaiman. In his stories, the old gods haunt American highways and back roads. Children are raised by ghosts in graveyards, and things lurk behind the walls of ordinary homes. Gaiman's first adult novel in nearly a decade, The Ocean at the End of the Lane, has just come out in paperback. It's a story about being 7 years old and about how our lives are shaped and scarred by childhood experiences.
The starting point was actually inspired by a real-life event that I heard about when I was in my 40s. It was 2003, and I had a Mini, new Mini Cooper, and I talked to my dad. I said, we used to have one of those. Whatever happened to that? Why did you get rid of it? It was such a great little car. And he said, have I never told you that story? And I said, no, you never have. And he told me about a lodger, how the guy went to the casino, gambled away all of his money, and then only intended to dip into his friend's money until he'd made back what he'd lost, and he lost everything. And he came back in the small hours of the morning and stole our car, and drove it to the end of the lane, and killed himself. Hearing this story was so strange. I'm going, well, I was seven. I never knew any of that happened. And he said, well, of course you didn't. It haunted me.
Did your parents keep that car? Did you drive it?
No, they sold it that afternoon.
You know, one of the questions at the heart of the book is thinking about how memory works, how it is that you can not remember something that you were part of.
When I'd finished writing The Ocean at the End of the Lane, I was looking at an interview that Art Spiegelman did with Maurice Sendak. There was a line that Maurice Sendak said. He said, I remember my own childhood vividly. I knew terrible things, but I knew I mustn't let adults know I knew. It would scare them. I remember feeling like that. I remember what it was like to be a kid, to feel like you had secret knowledge, to look at these adults blundering through the world, but you knew the world was more dangerous than they did.
We should talk about the three women, the Hempstock women, Letty, the little 11-year-old girl, and her mother and grandmother, who may live in a farmhouse but turn out to be very, very far from ordinary farm women. Tell us about them.
The Hempstocks, I suppose, began for me when I was a little kid. And I'd heard that a farm down our lane was mentioned in the Doomsday Book back in about the 11th century. So I started imagining that probably the farm was the same farm that I knew. I couldn't imagine that it looked any different from 1,000 years earlier. And that the same people had lived there for 1,000 years, maybe longer. And I just loved the idea that one day I'd get to do a story that was actually set in the lane that I grew up in, and then we'd actually meet the Hempstocks. They were much more of a kind of a triple goddess than I'd been planning.
I was going to ask you, are they the fates? Are they the triple goddess, maiden, mother, crone? And did you feel like you wrote them or invoked them?
I think they're all of those things. Young Letty Hempstock, who looks 11, but has been 11 for a very long time now, says that her duck pond is the ocean, and she came from the old country across that ocean. And her mother says that Letty can't remember the really old country, of course, because that sank. And old Mrs. Hempstock, who may or may not be able to remember the Big Bang, says that they're both wrong, and actually the really old country blew up.
Oh, that reminds me of there's this wonderful passage. I should ask you to read it. It's the part when Letty starts to sing for the first time.
Of course. The girl holding my hand said, if you ain't telling me your name, I'll bind you as a nameless thing, and you'll still be bound and tied and sealed like a polter or a shuck. She waited, but the thing said nothing. And Letty Hempstock began to say words in a language I did not know. Sometimes she was talking, and sometimes it was more like singing, in a tongue that was nothing I had ever heard. I knew the tune, though. It was a child's song, the tune to which we sang the nursery rhyme, Girls and Boys Come Out to Play. That was the tune. But her words were older words. I was certain of that. And as she sang, things happened beneath the orange sky. I have dreamed of that song, of the strange words to that simple rhyme song. In those dreams, I spoke that language too, the first language, and I had dominion over the nature of all that was real. In my dream, it was the tongue of what is, and anything spoken in it becomes real because nothing said in that language can be a lie. It is the most basic building brick of everything. In my dreams, I have used that language to heal the sick and to fly. Once I dreamed I kept a perfect little bed and breakfast by the seaside, and to everyone who came to stay with me, I would say, in that tongue, be whole. And they would become whole, not be broken people, not any longer, because I had spoken the language of shaping.
That is such a beautiful passage. And, you know, I feel like this is an old, old idea, this idea that there was an earlier, original language in which words made the world. What were you thinking about when you wrote this?
It goes back, of course, for me, to the Bible, the idea that God made the world by speaking it. In the beginning was the Word, and it's a lovely idea.
Are there other myths that you especially love that you or are taken by that you haven't taken into fiction yet?
Yes, there are a few, although also some of the myths that I love I just keep coming back to. The Norse gods just drag me back again and again. One of the oddest myth places that we don't do anything with, really, very much is early Christian myth.
What kind of early Christian myth?
There's a layer of sort of mythy stuff that grew up fairly early on. There was a gospel, one of the lost gospels, called the Gospel of the Infancy of Christ, in which we get to learn what young Jesus was like. And it's very mythic. It's not biblical Jesus at all, because young Jesus would do things like make clay statues of birds and bring them to life. And when a teacher would try to chastise him, the teacher would be struck down. And anybody who irritated boy Jesus would be either killed or turned blind, which I look at and I go, you know, there's something so strange, the idea that people were telling each other these stories. There was a craving for sort of like Superman and Superboy stories. They wanted the adventures of Jesus Christ when he was a boy. There's also the other one that I promised myself that I will go and do something with one day, and I really haven't, is the Egyptian gods. These glorious animal-headed creatures, I would love to do more with them.
What do you like about the feeling of those Egyptian gods?
It's hot, there's sand there, and they're slightly incomprehensible. They feel a little bit more like aliens. You know, the Greek gods feel like us. You read stories about what the Greek gods did and you go, okay, I get this. This is us. You read a good Egyptian god story and you go, maybe they came down from space. Why are they behaving like this? What is going on? It's odder. It's stranger. I would love to go and play in that sand pit.
Neil, is there a passage you'd choose to read at the end?
Let me do a little bit of Granny. I said, I promise, said Letty Hempstock, I won't let you be hurt. Hurt? Said a high, cracked voice. Who's hurt? What's been hurt? Why would anybody be hurt? It was old Mrs. Hempstock, her apron held between her hands, and in the hollow of the apron so many daffodils that the light reflected up from them transformed her face to gold. Letty said, something's causing trouble. She showed the old lady my shilling. My friend found himself choking on this shilling when he woke up this morning. Old Mrs. Hempstock put her apron on the kitchen table. Then she took the shilling from Letty. She squinted at it, sniffed it, rubbed at it, listened to it, or put it to her ear, at any rate, then touched it with the tip of her purple tongue. It's new, she said at last. It says 1912 on it, but it didn't exist yesterday. I looked up at old Mrs. Hempstock. How do you know? Good question, lovey. It's electron decay, mostly. You have to look at things closely to see the electrons. They're the little dinky ones that look like tiny smiles. The neutrons are the grey ones that look like frowns. The electrons were all a bit too smiley for 1912, so then I checked the sides of the letters in the old king's head, and everything was a tad too crisp and sharp. You must have very good eyesight. I told her. She gave me back the coin. Not as good as once it was, but then when you get to be my age, your eyesight won't be as sharp as it once was neither. How old is that? Letty looked at me, and I was worried that I'd said something rude. Sometimes adults didn't like to be asked their ages, and sometimes they did. Old Mrs. Hempstock went over to a cupboard and took out several colourful vases. Old enough, she said. I remember when the moon was made.
I love old Mrs. Hempstock. And I love it that you made one of the most powerful people in the book, maybe the most powerful person in the book, an old woman.
I wanted to put what I suppose I best describe as grandmotherly energy into the book. I remember both of my grandmothers very, very well. And grandmotherly places were the best places to be. And I wanted to try and take that feeling of welcome and that feeling of sort of sharp-eyed practicality and give all that to the Hempstocks.
Well, the world would be a better place if we had more grandmothers and if they also ran the world, as Mrs. Hempstock does. Neil, thanks so much for talking.
Oh, thank you, Anne.
Neil Gaiman is the best-selling author of American Gods and Coraline. His novel, The Ocean at the End of the Lane, is now out in paperback. And that wraps up our discussion on fantasy and weird fiction. Coming up, cosmologist Lawrence Krauss tells us why science has replaced philosophy and religion as the place to deal with the big questions. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
Hi, my name is Rebecca Goldstein, and I'm a philosopher and sometimes a novelist as well. And I'm the author of Plato at the Googleplex, Why Philosophy Won't Go Away. And my dangerous idea is to teach children, adolescents, to be rigorous, critical thinkers, to never be allowed to just put forth an opinion without putting forth some kind of justification for it, for teaching them what it is to justify their beliefs, for teaching them what a formal argument is. When I was teaching, and I was always teaching in really quite good places, I would have students come into a first course in philosophy, and they didn't know what it was to really argue for their beliefs. Oh, you know, I feel this, I feel that. Oh, that doesn't seem right to me. And the whole idea of a rigorous formal argument, tell me your premises. Now let's look at these premises. Which do you think are the weakest? Let's try to judge this argument that you have. That kind of self-critical thinking just hadn't occurred. I think there's a lot of memorization of facts. There's a lot of learning various skills, all very, very important. But this is an extra little bit of it. And I don't see it being taught based on what my students came in and based on having had two children who I followed in their school. People, very, very often, teachers insist this is the way it's done, and they insist on their authority, and they themselves have not been taught how to think critically. The reason I find that this would be such a dangerous idea is that it would make things very hard for a lot of people in power. It would make it very hard for any kind of ideology to get by unquestioned, ideology, whether it was religious or secular. It would make the life of politicians much, much more difficult. It would make the life of all demagogues much, much more difficult if we trained people from the very earliest to be acutely aware of when they are being BS'd. I think children naturally care about the truth, but truth doesn't just come to us. We have to really fight our way for it. We have to really use every faculty at our command to try to get at it. And if we were to train our children in a love and a respect, a reverence for the truth, and then in some of the techniques that are needed in order to judge truth, I think that would be very revolutionary, and it would be dangerous to the people who ought to be endangered.
Rebecca Goldstein is a philosopher and novelist and author of Plato at the Googleplex, Why Philosophy Won't Go Away. You'll find more dangerous ideas on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. This week, the cosmologist and well-known atheist Lawrence Krauss has our attention. He's not only one of America's most visible physicists, the author of a number of popular science books, including A Universe from Nothing. He's also the subject, along with Richard Dawkins, of the new documentary film The Unbelievers. Krauss recently stopped by our studio to talk with Steve Paulson about science, religion, and the big existential questions.
Lawrence, one of the things that you've done in a lot of your work is explore fundamental questions about the nature of the world that we live in. You ask the big questions. What is reality? How did our universe begin? How can you get something from nothing? Frankly, the questions that philosophers used to ask
for centuries. Well, I think
for centuries.
Philosophers, I think they're the questions that everyone asks. We all ask that at some level about our world. And it's true that philosophy has been very important in framing these questions. But eventually, science takes over. You're not going to answer these questions philosophically or theologically, for that matter.
I mean, so you're saying all those big questions, the big existential questions, are now science questions?
They are or will be. Whenever you say why, you don't really mean why. Because if you say why and think you mean why, you're presuming purpose. What if there isn't purpose? So really what you mean often when you're asking why is how.
But you are asking, why are we here? Well, in more than just the, you know, because I was born from my parents.
Well, no, I don't know whether you are. Because if you think there's some reason why we're here, then you're assuming there must be a purpose for us to be here. But what if there is no purpose? So you can keep asking why questions, but I don't know if you have any children. But anyone who has children knows the only there's an infinite succession of why questions. And the only answer that really works is because. Go to bed.
Boy, you are a cynic. Really, that's what you tell. I don't know if you have children.
No, but, yeah, and not really. But I think, but we're really trying to say, what do you mean when you ask, why are we here? Don't you mean what conditions of the universe allowed us to develop? And to find out, you have to look at the universe. And that's what I mean by it's a scientific question. You can't just some people think they can, by revelation, get the answer. But that always leads to the wrong answer. You've got to look and ask, is there any evidence of purpose to the universe? And it means you have to open your mind to the possibility that there may not be a purpose. Now, that may upset you or depress you. You can say, okay, let's say there is no purpose to the universe. I can find that enlightening and enlivening and enriching. The fact that it's a complete accident that I'm here, but I'm fortunate enough to have evolved a brain that allows me to ask these questions and to learn about the universe and to enjoy my brief moment in the sun and have this conversation with you. So in that sense, we make our own purpose.
Let me throw out a different word, meaning, you know, which is not the same as purpose. I mean, how do we find meaning in our lives?
We make our own meaning.
So science, that's not a scientific question. Then.
Well, no. I hate when people say it's not a scientific question. I don't like to compartmentalize knowledge. But what do you mean by meaning? You have to ask that question. And if the meaning is what is the cosmic context in which this phenomena is occurring, then of course science has a great deal to say about it. But if you mean, is there any fundamental meaning beyond the physical, it's probably a useless question because it doesn't get you very far.
But it's a question an awful lot of people ask.
That's because we're hardwired, I think, to look for meaning. In order to survive, you'd like to think that things aren't completely capricious, and that's some of the origin of science, but it's also the origin of religion and myth. Because you create these stories because it often helps you to think if the trees are rustling, maybe it's a tiger. And we don't want to be alone in the universe. We want to be more out there than meets the eye. I think we all do that.
Obviously, you are a critic of religion and a lot of the stories that
I'm a critic of myth and superstition, yeah.
And there are plenty of religious believers who don't take the Bible literally. And they say that's not ultimately what religion is about. But one thing that religion does do is it does provide us stories by which to live. I mean, stories
that... What do you mean by stories by which to live? Do you stone your children, kill and rape others? I mean...
Unto others as they would do unto you.
Oh, well, you know, I don't think that's... I certainly don't think that's the lesson of the Bible as far as I can see.
It's one of the lessons and one of the lessons that you find in all religions.
Well, I don't know. I think in many... I mean, look, religion is many things to many people. So religion isn't all bad, okay? Because what people, most people do, especially in the first world, is they pick and choose the stuff they like. They don't take the parts of the Bible that they don't like. They just throw it out.
Let me shift the conversation back to science here. Now, there are...
By the way, I think science has something to do about that. Because to know either what other people want or what you want, you have to know the consequences of your actions. You have to know what something will produce. That's science. Without knowing the consequences of your actions, which is an empirical statement, you can't even ask that moral question or at least answer it.
Well, I mean, actually, that's a fascinating question. Can science answer the big moral questions? What is right? What is wrong? I mean, science can certainly give us information, but can it actually answer those questions, which would seem to be ultimately philosophical questions?
Well, depends what you mean by answer. My definition of science is a fairly broad one. It is empirical data combined with rational analysis to make predictions about the world and to decide, in some sense, how to act in the world. And that, in that sense, I would argue that people's morality is not determined by religion. Most people, if they didn't believe in God, would not go out and kill their neighbors, okay? And in fact, we organize our society around, in principle, rational arguments, and science informs those rational arguments.
The question I'm interested in here is, how much of the world we live in can science explain? I mean, that's sort of...
And the answer is we don't know, and that's what makes it so wonderful. But what's really frustrating when some people say, oh, science will never answer this question. Well, how do you know if you don't try? I mean, we ultimately may understand the fundamental nature of consciousness and be able to decode decision-making and everything, including moral decision-making, and then science may address these questions. But we just don't know. So to say to something, sorry, it's not science, it's beyond the domain of science, it's just to close your mind. And what we've discovered, and one of the reasons I wrote the book I just did, is that 40 years ago we would have thought science couldn't even address some of these questions. And we may come up to fundamental limits on what we know, but we don't know until we try.
What do you make of the criticism from some circles? People talk about scientism, the idea that all the important questions are ultimately science questions. And if science cannot answer them, they are either not real questions or not questions worth asking.
You know, most people are accused of scientism, including me. I don't think they would argue that. It's funny that people talk about that, but they don't talk about religionism. And as if somehow, you know, many people argue that these ultimate questions must be the province of religion. In fact, all important questions are the province.
But a lot of people who talk about scientism are not necessarily just resorting to religious answers.
But the key question is there any knowledge that can be obtained by pure reflection or revelation and not by empirical investigation of the world around you? And I would argue that it's reasonably likely to say that there isn't. That we humans behave and have perceptions and feelings that we have knowledge, but almost all of it comes from experience.
But experience is not the same as science. I mean, experience is, you know, you do something, you reflect on it. I mean, that's not...
What I just argued science is, to me, is taking empirical data, evidence of reality, and using rational thinking. Now, there are obviously components in our life that don't seem to be addressed by science. Love, many things. Although eventually we may know what all the biochemical and neurophysiological things that lead you to fall in love. And for some people, that may take the wonder and awe out of it. But like Feynman said about a rainbow, just knowing how a rainbow works doesn't make it less beautiful. It makes it more beautiful. So it just depends on your approach.
You mentioned your last book, A Universe from Nothing. And when that book came out, you had some run-ins with philosophers of science.
Very few, yeah.
But especially on this question of, how can you get something from nothing? And you made the argument, drawing on quantum field theory, which I don't have a clue how to understand, so I'll sort of take your explanation for it.
No, I'm trying to explain it. Go on. Don't take anyone's explanation for anything. That's the first thing.
And physics understands the notion of a vacuum, which is very different than the nothingness that a philosopher would say.
Well, that's one version of nothing. By the way, that's a pretty good definition of nothing. If you ask people what's nothing, like the nothing of the Bible was a vast, infinite void. It was space, but there was nothing there. So for many people's version of nothing is empty space. That's one version of nothing. But as I describe, physics actually goes much further and actually argues about whether not just space with quantum fields in it can come from nothing, but whether space and time themselves, our universe, everything that we associate with our universe, all the space and all the time, could result from no space and no time. Now, you can argue the semantics of whether that's nothing, but that's, if you wish, the miracle that religion tried to usurp. And that, quote-unquote, miracle is what modern science is discovering doesn't need any supernatural shenanigans. Now, you can ask another question. You could say, well, what about the laws that governed?
Right. I mean, that's the next question. I mean, the deeper question is, okay, you have this quantum field theory, which, you know, and there's this whole theory of how things can pop out of the vacuum as defined
by
physics.
No, there's no vacuum. There was nothing there. There was no space, no time. But we're getting the same point. The question is, what established the laws that allowed our universe, and by our universe, I mean everything that we see that didn't exist before.
And why do we have these laws of quantum physics to begin with?
Yeah, and that's a fascinating question. One of the possibilities that is fascinating is that there are no fundamental laws. That, in fact, universes are created, each universe with different laws, and maybe even quantum mechanics is unique to our universe. And by the way, that's my point, is that our definition of nothing has changed. There's nothing bad about that. It's what we call learning. Okay. And so the question, what happened before, may not be a good question, because there may be no before, because of space and time were created in our universe. Time may be an emergent concept too. And that very question, all those causal questions, which may seem so important to us, may not be good questions if there is no before.
I want to follow on one thing you said, which I find absolutely fascinating. You said that maybe there is no underlying order. I mean, because for decades, physicists dreamed of a theory of everything.
I think for all of physics.
For all of physics.
I was trained I wanted to be a physicist because I wanted to know how the universe worked and why it had to be exactly the way it is. I still would like that to be the case. But we're learning that that may not be the case. And that's the wonderful thing about science, is that as ugly as it might be, as much as I hate the idea, if the evidence of reality points us in that direction, we'll have to go there. But you're absolutely right. It is a fundamental change that for some physicists is occurring. You know, that's what's great about science. It pushes us to areas we would never have come up with by revelation. If we locked the theoretical physicist in a room and asked her what's the next great thing and without access to data, she'd come up with something nonsensical. Quantum mechanics was forced upon us kicking and screaming. The expanding universe that's accelerating was forced upon us kicking and screaming. And that's what's great about it. Nature has a much bigger imagination than we do, and it offends a lot of people that we keep having to change our fundamental notions, but gosh, that's what makes it so great to be human.
Lawrence Krauss is a cosmologist at Arizona State University, and the subject, along with Richard Dawkins, of the documentary film The Unbelievers. Steve's complete, unedited interview with Krauss is posted on our website at ttbook.org. Now, if you're a regular listener, you know, to the best of our knowledge, it's a show that likes to ask big questions. Maybe you've got some answers. You can comment on this conversation, or any others, on our website at ttbook.org, or also social media, Facebook or Twitter. The handle is ttbook1. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, Raymond Tungekar, and Doug Gordon. Our technical director is Kirill Owen, and I'm Ann Strandchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.